Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump has picked Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas and fellow climate change denier, to lead the energy department that he once advocated abolishing. What's behind Trump's picking someone for a department he feels has no value? We are joined from New Mexico by Greg Mello. He is the secretary and executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you very much, Brian. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining. What's behind Donald Trump's decision to choose Rick Perry to lead the energy department? Is it about lining the pockets of big oil and gas? I mean, you've issued a statement. Talk about how you view the nomination.
Sure. Yes, it's partly about lining the pockets of Donald Trump's base. But really, it, like other appointments in the energy and environment area, it's about clearing the way for a kind of a drill, baby, drill policy that will emphasize U.S. fossil fuel development and, you know, get the obstacles out of the way. Also, there's an animus against many parts of DOE. They don't like climate research, energy, or renewable energy conservation. They don't like the loan programs that favor renewable energy, and they want to find a way to keep nuclear power plants open as long as possible, see if there's a way to get the Yucca Mountain project for nuclear waste disposal going again without having to open up the Nuclear Waste Policy Act. I think they want to push small modular reactors. So I'm getting this from the questions which were submitted to the Department of Energy by the transition team. There are, let's see, 74 questions to the DOE, and they're very specific, and they, taken together, they outline a very specific agenda for the Department of Energy.
Perry is the former Republican governor of Texas. I guess people most remember his relationship to the Energy Department because he said it was one of the three agencies that should be abolished, but in that famous oops moment, he couldn't actually remember the name of the agency. I could only name two of them. When you look at it, of course, that's sort of cavalier and sort of a way for liberals to make fun of Perry, but it's kind of no laughing matter when you talk about and think about what's at stake.
Yes, it's certainly true. I think also the Trump people believe that Texas can be a kind of a model. There's a sense that Texas did well because of liberating its oil and gas industries, and he created a lot of jobs, and so it can be replicated elsewhere. Well, of course, it can't. There's a lot of oil and gas in Texas, and there isn't so much in other places.
A few years ago, Perry's top environmental officials in Texas removed all mentions of climate change from a report on rising sea levels in the Galveston Bay. What do you think about the Trump administration or the government that's taking shape in terms of its orientation towards climate change? And of course, you see who's being appointed to the EPA. Huffington Post had an article, it's entitled, "It's Hard to Overstate How Anti-Environment Donald Trump's Cabinet Picks Are." What do you make of that? Is it sounding the alarm in a sort of sensationalized way, or is this a real danger in terms of what's coming with U.S. government policy?
I don't think it is sounding an excessive alarm. I think it is very alarming. And he is about as an anti-environmental as one could imagine, and he will do things which would be previously unimaginable. I think we don't know what they all are, but we can just try to exercise our imaginations. I should have mentioned that Rick Perry, for example, is on the board of Energy Transfer Partners, which is building the Dakota Access Pipeline. So, you know, that's it's kind of breathtaking.
Yeah.
And there'll be a lot of that. Now, but we should say that in a way what Trump is doing is ripping the mask off. You know, it's not like the Obama administration or a potential Hillary Clinton administration would be fabulously environmental or would be solving the climate problem. They would have a much nicer veneer. They would not be so in your face. they wouldn't. But would they actually do a lot of substantive things that would impede the fossil fuel industry? No, I don't think they would. So I think the message for all of us in this is that people have to really stand up and not look to, wistfully look to the federal government to solve the problems that we should be solving in our communities and in our states.
Greg Mello, you are the secretary and executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group in New Mexico. You are a scientific expert. Tell us about the work of your organization, the Los Alamos Study Group. And you're quoted in the study group's press release, as we've been talking about, the statement that you issued 2 days ago, saying Perry's mandate may be less about management and more about being a wrecking ball, which would fit into his prior predilections. But first, start with your organization and what you're doing and what your primary concerns are.
Yes, we are primarily a nuclear disarmament, nuclear policy organization. We've done a lot of things through the decades. We do a lot of lobbying in Washington on the one hand, and some local organizing out here on the other, litigation. We are working to stop the push for new kinds of nuclear weapons and construction of a large factory out here to replace the Rocky Flats plant that was closed down in 1989. We've successfully blocked various plans that have been put forward, but of course, every few years, then there's another plan. So now we have another plan they have to fight. So that's probably our biggest project. And the second part, yes, Perry is largely going to be a wrecking ball. I think there's been a long-term conservative dissatisfaction with the Department of Energy, and part of it is soundly based. The Department of Energy is very badly managed. It does not produce a great deal of value for the country. In some areas, it does, however. And the biggest program in the DOE, which Perry, I guess, knows by now, is nuclear weapons. And it's a management challenge and it's a moral challenge. And the Trump administration has been pretty silent about it.
You're the Los Alamos Study Group. Los Alamos is the site of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Talk about that, and talk about if the people who are working with your study group have had a longstanding connection to the National Laboratory. Are your colleagues also scientists?
Well, some are. Some are scientists, and we started at the end of the Cold War with the idea that we could convert some of these institutions to a more peaceful direction, but that was a failure. They can't really be converted. We wanted to block the resurgence of weapons programs after the Cold War, and we've been partially successful there. We had a lot of allies within the weapons laboratories in the beginning, but gradually those folks have retired or been forced out, and now there's a real corporate mentality that, frankly, puts public service somewhere down in the priority list, and it's really all about corporate profit and individual salary, and they make sure that the employees are very frightened and can't take part in anything like the Los Alamos Study Group without risking their jobs.
Los Alamos was the place. It got started as part of the Manhattan Project, right?
Correct.
So talk about that.
Well, it was called Site Y during the Manhattan Project, and let's see now, I think $75 million then. In those dollars.
And the Manhattan Project, for our broader audience, was?
To make the first atomic bombs and to drop them on Japan. And then in 1945, Los Alamos faced a kind of a crisis. Should it continue? If so, as what? Within about 2 years, that was resolved, and it became the bomb lab which we know today. So it's been going on for however many years, seven decades, almost eight decades, and it's still a bomb factory. It designs nuclear weapons. It produces parts for nuclear weapons. It does some non-proliferation work and a smattering of other scientific research, and now there's also a cleanup program to try to fix up some of the environmental mess that has been caused over time, although it's not been entirely successful.
Greg Miller, let's talk about the politics of nuclear weapons, too, because, of course, the Department of Energy has responsibilities towards the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Donald Trump seemed to be advocating during the 2016 election campaign that there should be a proliferation of nuclear weapons. He was suggesting, I think, that Korea and Japan should have their own nuclear weapons. A lot of people discounted that as reckless talk. But the United States, even though the Cold War has ended, seems to be modernizing nuclear weapons, making them more usable, introducing a new generation of nuclear weapons. Do you think the Donald Trump campaign will continue those projects that President Obama sort of signed off on, at least? And what about Japan? What about South Korea? What about nuclear proliferation?
Yes. Well, this is the $1 trillion question. The Trump campaign said contradictory things. So his very hawkish pick for Secretary of Defense has said last year in congressional testimony, not just idle comment, that he didn't believe that ICBMs were, that is, the land-based strategic missiles, which the United States has about 450 of which 400 are ready to launch at any minute. He didn't think that they were valuable for the United States. Well, we don't either. And so he thought they were more destabilizing and frightening and subject to problems in command and control than they were worth. And this is very much a counter to the present doctrine, and we certainly do welcome that.
So you're talking about the nominee for Secretary of Defense, General Mattis.
Yes, exactly. General Mattis is not a fan. He is a Marine, or former Marine, I'm sorry. It is a Freudian slip. He is not a fan of ICBMs. And the Marines, of course, have no nuclear weapons. And we've seen this before from other senior Marine generals, like General Cartwright, who can look at the nuclear deterrent and say, why do we have all this stuff? Why do we have a belt and suspenders and a belt and suspenders for our belt and suspenders? And it's very, very expensive. So that on the one hand, that's really good. On the other hand, he has said, I want to build up the military, and the nuclear weapons tend to go along with that. And so we don't know how that's going to come down. On the question of proliferation, we don't know how that's going to come down either. We're relatively positive about Trump's attitude toward Russia. But I think that right now we are seeing a struggle over the direction of Trump's foreign policy acted out in a lot of, a lot of people really question his relationship with Russia and his potential relationship with Russia. We have built up a tremendous Russophobic response in the last three or so years, and we at the study group believe that's very dangerous, it's very unwarranted, and if that can be punctured and brought back down to a more rational level, we'd love to see that. And that would make it possible to cut nuclear weapons and to cooperate with Russia on terrorism and potentially even on climate change. Which is something that we think should be promoted as well, but we doubt if Trump will do it.
Right. So Russia has thousands of nuclear weapons. The United States has thousands of nuclear weapons. The Obama administration, both with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State in the first 4 years and then John Kerry in the second 4 years, agreed that they would sign off at least on the modernization of nuclear weapons, having lower yield weapons. In other words, weapons that could be more usable as tactical weapons in battlefield situations. And of course, nuclear weapons haven't been used since August 1945 with the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And at the same time, there was a lot of growing tension and is a lot of growing tension between the United States and NATO and Russia, even along Russia's border. That is playing with fire when you recognize, or we recognize, that once one or adversaries or potential adversaries start climbing the escalation ladder, it's pretty It's easy to get on that ladder. It's hard to get off. And when both sides of the ladder have nuclear weapons, the catastrophic impact can't be overstated. And yet there seemed to be a cavalier attitude towards all of that with Hillary Clinton and, again, with the Democratic Party.
Couldn't agree more, Brian. And I've been in Washington a lot. I've been in the old executive office building talking to the National Security Council. They have a very mistaken idea about our relationship with Russia and what can be done. They think Russia will back down because their experience is based on the 1990s in the immediate post-Cold War era. They imagine they can just keep pushing Russia farther and farther and bring NATO up to the Russian border, do more and more provocation, and eventually break Russia, replace their leadership, have some kind of regime change, and I think that's a very, very dangerous idea, but it's very widespread in Washington. And we have got to get off that escalator that you described.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking with Greg Mello. He is the secretary and executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group in New Mexico. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.